Today, we consider two anniversaries of tragedy. Of course, this is the week of the 10th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. But this also is the anniversary, the 40th anniversary of the great tragedy at the Attica prison in upstate New York, where prisoners were massacred after a rebellion. We'll be speaking live with radical attorney Sarah Kunstler, whose father was very much involved in the negotiations during that tragic time. Also, we will be speaking with Paul Arpaia of September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows about the consequences of the reactions and the string of wars that followed the events of September 11th. And this is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And WBAI will, in fact, be broadcasting a live presentation of a major event taking place at the Riverside Church this weekend, when people from all across the country and around the world will be gathering to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the prison slaughter at Attica, where there was an uprising and the killing of the inmates who had rebelled. Attica is All of Us is the group that has put this together, and they say that conditions inside the prisons are just as bad today, particularly with the expansion of prisoners of color and prisoners of poverty, that the same conditions exist. In a few moments, we'll be speaking live with event organizer Sarah Kunstler, the daughter of the radical attorney Bill Kunstler, who was one of the observers at the events of Attica. Sarah and her sister Emily Kunstler are also the co-producers of the Bill Kunstler biographical film called Disturbing the Universe, which in part does deal with some of the events of Attica.
And when the inmate's mediator, William Kunstler, was turned away at the prison gate, he took that as a sign that the attack was imminent. That is, 2 days of work to end this uprising peacefully had failed.
What did the guard tell you?
He said he had just received orders that no one but uniformed personnel would be permitted in.
Why do you think that they're not letting you in, Mr. Kunstler?
I think they're killing people.
5 a.m. September 13th. We're on the roof of A Block, waiting for the assault to begin. This is a team of 270 rifle shooters.
Your instructions are that your weapon is not to be taken, nor are you to be taken. You're to meet force with force. There have been some of the prison personnel severely injured here this morning, and we certainly don't want to see any of our people hurt.
Started shooting, it was like all hell broke loose. And the shooting just seemed to go on and on and on and on, and bullets were hitting all around, and you could hear people crying, and you could hear people dying. And it was just like they indiscriminately shot everyone.
I smell gas, the drop, some sort of tear gas. And I heard the sounds of shooting. And I knew that people were being murdered inside there. And I began to cry.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning. Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in four decades.
Power. 450 people fired over 4,500 rounds of ammunition, including weapons with ammunition that's outlawed by the Geneva Convention, dum-dum bullets that exploded on impact.
In the final hours of the revolt, led primarily by blacks, the inmates murdered 9 of their white hostages. 28 convicts were killed by state troopers and sheriff's deputies who regained control of the prison.
Prison officials told the press that the hostages were killed by prisoners who slit their throats. But they lied. everyone who died that day was killed by state gunfire.
And that was an excerpt from Disturbing the Universe, filmed by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we're now joined live by radical attorney Sarah Kunstler. You have been spearheading much of the work to organize a major event at the Riverside Church commemorating the 40th anniversary of Attica. Sarah, welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow, and what is the meaning that you bring to Attica for us today?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I mean, for me, personally, Attica has a lot of resonance because of both of my parents' connection to it. Both my mother and father represented prisoners who were charged as a result of the rebellion. But what we're looking to do with the event tomorrow night is make a connection between Attica and the prison system today and have a conversation about how the United States came to have the largest prison population in the world and what steps we can take together to reverse this reality. So that is the message of our evening.
The conditions today are said to be no different from before, with only perhaps cosmetic changes. What is your assessment of the state of prisons there and around the country?
Well, in 1971, when the Attica Rebellion and Massacre took place, there were, I think, around 300,000 people in prison. Today, we have over 2.4 million people in prison in this country. Even before we look at the conditions, it's just kind of staggering that we incarcerate that percentage or that many people, that large percentage of our population. But, prisoners still, are paid cents on the dollar for their labor. They're exploited even more so today by corporations who use that labor. Prisons still tear apart families and put inordinate burdens on families of prisoners to maintain relationships. I mean, there's just as there was in 1971, there is an entire lack of humanity when it concerns people who are behind bars. We lock them up, we forget about them, and we don't treat them like human beings.
Sarah Kunstler is the daughter, of course, of Bill Kunstler and Margaret Ratner Kunstler, a family of radical attorneys, along with film producer Emily and many other members of Accomplishment. And Sarah, you're also a law partner with Liz Fink. And did she not have something to do with Attica litigation? What was that process, and were people ever held accountable?
Elizabeth Fink, who is my mentor and teacher and whom I work with in the practice of law, she worked on the civil case against the state to hold the state responsible for the killings and the brutalization at Attica for 27 years, which is really astounding. You know, one, that it took that long to have some measure of justice, and also that, one person could maintain that fight for that many years. But, along with Attica Brothers Legal Defense, Frank Big Black Smith, a group of committed people, she did that work, and it had needless to say, it had a profound effect on her, the way she sees the state, the way she sees prisons and the treatment of incarcerated people. And, I benefit from that experience and that knowledge.
Sarah, the event this weekend at Riverside WBAI will be broadcasting much of it. But can you tell people what to expect to find? What kind of a reunion, what kind of gathering will it be?
We are going to have, we have two panels planned for the evening. One, a roundtable discussion of Attica brothers who are going to be sharing their experiences. And that panel is moderated by Jamal Joseph and features Joseph Harris, Calvin Hutchinson, William Maynard, Melvin Muhammad, Che Nieves, Carlos Roche, Al-Haji Sharif, and Al-Haji Sharif. We also have poetry by Amiri Baraka. We have a statement delivered by L.D. Barkley in the yard in September 10th, 1971, read by Gabenga Akinagbe, an actor best known for his role on The Wire on HBO. He's going to read Barclay's impassioned speech. L.D. Barkley was 21 at the time, and he was murdered in the retaking of the prison several days later. We have a panel focusing on Attica now and what Attica means today, with moderated by Amy Goodman and featuring Cornel West, Joseph Jazz Hayden, Elizabeth Fink from my office, Sophia Elijah from the Correctional Association, Asha Bandele from Drug Policy Alliance, and former political prisoner Daruba Bin Wahan. And you know, it's going to be a great evening.
Well, congratulations on all of the hard and meaningful work, and please, everyone, come to the Riverside this weekend, this Friday and Saturday. And Sarah Kunstler, keep up the great work, and best regards to Elizabeth, your colleagues, and the family.
Thank you so much. It's nice to speak with you.
Always. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. Hear now Muhammad Ali.
This poem explains the Attica prison. You heard that over here when all the black prisoners were shot, and just before they held some white hostages, and they say they would cut the throats if they didn't get what they wanted. And the word was, well, if the throats are cut, then shoot and kill everybody. They found out during the autopsy that the throats were not cut. They just shot them for nothing, the trigger-happy policeman. And that Rockefeller gave word 10 minutes or so, if they don't give up, I think it's the way it went, open fire. And one black prisoner came out to speak to the warden. He said, you have 10 minutes to surrender. What's your reply? Are we going to come in shooting? And the black prisoner came out. Poetic poem. This didn't happen, but this is what I wrote. He said, better far from all I see, to die fighting to be free, what more fitting end could be? Better surely than in some bed, where in broken health I'm led, lingering until I'm dead. Better than with prayers and pleas, are in the clutch of some disease, wasting slowly by degrees. Better than of heart attack or some dose of drug I lack. Let me die by being black. Better far that I should go, standing here against the foe. Is there sweeter death to know? Better than the bloody stain on some highway where I'm lain, torn by flying glass and pain. Better call in death to come than to die another dumb, muted victim in the slum. Better than of this prison rot, if there's any choice I've got, kill me here on the spot. Better far my fight to wage now while my blood boils with rage, lest it cool with ancient age. Better violent for us to die than to Uncle Tom and try, making peace just to live a lie. Better now that I say my sooth, I'm gonna die demanding truth while I'm still akin to youth. Better now than later on, now that fear of death is gone, never mind another darn. They opened fire on them, but they died telling it like it was.
Muhammad Ali, on Attica. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we, in today's program, commemorate yet another anniversary of tragedy, the events of September 11, 2001. Not that it's unique in the world. There are civilian deaths through military and other subterfuges and methods all around the world every day and have been throughout history. But this is one that touches us quite poignantly because of its proximity. And we are taken by the fact that the tragedy has been compounded by war, generating even more tragedies. To address that very subject, we are now joined live by Paul Arpaia of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Paul has just returned from Afghanistan. And Paul, welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow. And what did you see in Kabul?
Well, I saw a incredibly beautiful city with beautiful people who are an expression of the triumph of the human spirit, who have been able to begin building their lives among the violence that is meted out upon them by ISAF and its allies and its enemies. It was incredible to see how these people could even go about their daily lives as they do. Each activity seemed to be a symbol of resistance against the violence that is perpetrated against them. On one hand, it's very sad, but on the other hand, one sees that there is hope in Afghanistan.
Well, tactically, perhaps in some parts of the country, but we're also hearing that the Taliban is resurgent, that there are ongoing tribal and behavioral and ethnic conflicts within the country, and an enmity between many members of the U.S. Created police and military forces there. And do you have any feeling, or did you get any sense that there is an intractability about the U.S. occupation there? And appended to that, I would ask, did you see much evidence of the presence not only of U.S. troops, but of the mercenaries who equal or outnumber them from the United States?
Well, you know, things are worse off than they've ever been. We heard spin from some diplomats who we talked to, and it was interesting to see how they spun data to make things look better. But we talked to victims groups. I talked to members of civil society. I talked to foreign doctors, and they all agree. Even the United Nations Human Rights Commissioner, every single person agreed in separate discussions with me that things are getting worse, not better. And yet the Afghan people keep on trying to fight. They keep on trying to resist against this, and they really need our help. One time when I was with the group that was called Afghana, and the Tavola della Pace, the two Italian pacifist groups. We walked the streets of Kabul. You can walk them. There's no danger. We were taken once to be contractors, and people refused to serve us until we were able to make them understand that we were not American contractors. You don't see very many Americans and contractors unless, you know, you count the SUVs, the bulletproof SUVs with darkened windows that go whizzing by, the Americans hide in these cement fortifications. They appear to be really distrusted and even hated by the Afghan people because of the violence that they carry out towards the Afghanis, and in particular, I mean, the contractors. Although, you know, when I ask people, you know, who do you fear more, soldiers or contractors, they didn't know there was a difference between the two. They didn't understand that contractors and soldiers are two different groups, which I found quite appalling, especially since I've worked with veterans who are very angry at the contractors because of how they caused distrust towards Americans by their wanton destruction and violence towards the Afghan people.
Well, the contractors are one of President Obama's most successful jobs creation programs. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we are speaking with Paul Arpaia. And Paul, you are, of course, with September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And I'd like you to take these closing moments to identify, like, who, you know, what kinds of relatives and victims are members of the organization, and what you think about the wars that have ensued from one tragedy creating another.
Well, we are people who have lost family members in September 11th. We are dedicated to peace. We look for peaceful solutions. We've been against the war before it even started. And we have argued that even, you know, things like the killing of Osama bin Laden are not solutions. All it does is add to a cycle of violence that will never stop. We need to put the genie back into the bottle. It's going to be harder now more than ever after 10 years of war. We have a current administration that is carrying out the same policies as the previous one, and it needs to come to a stop. We need to stop the war. Civilians are getting getting killed. They're getting maimed. It's just... You know, it's amazing to walk the streets of Kabul and see how many people are hobbling on crutches with just one leg. I mean, you just begin to realize the enormity of the cost to the civilian people of Afghanistan. And, you know, from my friends who have gone to Iraq, they've seen the similar things in Iraq. It's time to say, let's stop the war. It hasn't worked.
It seems as if your colleagues have... brought to this great tragedy and this loss, more sadness than madness in terms of retaliatory violence. And that is I think, a refreshing and a necessary thing to be heard. How can people find out more about your and others' good work with September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows?
Well, they can come to our website. All they have to do is Google Peaceful Tomorrows and they'll find us. We have links to other organizations that work with us. They can feel free to donate to our organization. We're always in need of funding to carry on our message. They can look at the links page as well. We invite them to join with us. I think, you know, when I went to Kabul and I heard these civilians saying, why don't you join with us? Why don't more Americans help us? You know, I realized how many Americans don't know how to help and don't know that they can. You know, I took the extraordinary measure of going to Kabul, but we don't all need to go to Kabul. We can do things at home to try to get our government to stop making war and to get, you know, get the money out, get the business out of making money off killing people. I mean, it's just incredible.
Well, thank you for the clarity. Paul Arpaia of September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. And today we continue our theme of dual tragic anniversaries from Attica to September 11th and all of the ensuing warfare and additional loss of life. And we continue in that vein with a tale of two tales of the events of September 11th. We will hear some of your radio network's coverage of those events, the contemporaneous coverage. And we also hear a different approach. That's the other tale, by way of this brief encounter between a colleague of ours, Sam Husseini, of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's now based in Washington, D.C., formerly of New York. And he was there the next day, that is on the 13th of September 2001, on a program whose host took a different direction than some of us might do on that occasion. And here now we hear Sam Husseini in discussion and a poignant debate with Bill O'Reilly of Fox TV News.
All right, while most Americans are united in their support of President Bush and the desire to bring Osama bin Laden and other terrorists to justice, there are some differing voices. Joining us now from Washington is Sam Husseini, the former spokesman for the Arab Anti-American Anti-Discrimination Committee. And from Urbana, Illinois, is Francis Boyle, an international law professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. All right, Sam, you've been on the program before. I'm just going to give you a chance to tell us how you're feeling tonight about all of this.
I think that we have to look at where are we going with this. I mean, just a minute ago, Bill, you were saying that soldiers don't kill women and children.
Correct.
But yet, I mean, what sickened me was the act of what happened and that people would kill so many innocent people. But now I hear a drumbeat of having our soldiers kill women and children.
Well, wait a minute. That hasn't happened. People overreact. If there is bombing, of course, maybe other innocent people might get killed. And I don't believe we're gonna have indiscriminate bombing. We might have targeted bombing in military places. But look,
Bill, we have a history of this. I mean, Colin Powell advocated, apparently, during the buildup of the Gulf War, flooding Baghdad and killing possibly 4 million people. Papers are now coming out in a magazine called The Progressive that we intentionally took out their water and their electrical facilities.
I'm not getting your point at all.
Please,
all right. I mean,
please,
if you're going to start to justify this kind of an atrocity with past atrocities,
excuse me?
I'm going to pull a plug on you.
Bill, I'm doing the exact opposite. I'm saying that. Are you doing that? Are you saying that some atrocities are good and some are bad? I'm saying all atrocities are bad.
All right, but I'm saying to you that...
I'm tired of coming on and condemning atrocities. I want the atrocities to stop.
But they
will
won't stop.
Will you join me in stopping all the atrocities?
No, look, Mr. Husseini, let's be unemotional here and rational. You just heard the FBI agent who arrested the first World Trade Center bomber say, can't reason with them, you can't convince them, you can't do anything to stop them other than kill them or incarcerate them for life.
But
that's
who's
it.
Them? Who's the,
well,
we want to get
the
perpetrators. Of course we want to get the perpetrators.
And there
the
are
who did this.
And we want to get
the
people. And we want to get the people who harbored them.
Of course. There's no argument about that. But look at the last time we went through this. The last time our embassies, people took out our embassies in East Africa. What did we do? We bombed the Sudan. What did we hit in the Sudan? We hit a pharmaceutical plant that was supplying the pharmacies for an impoverished African country.
That was a mistake.
Are we going to do the same thing here?
I hope
we're
not.
Are we just going to reflexively, quote-unquote, retaliate?
Here's what we're going to do, Mr. Husseini.
And kill innocent civilians and not the perpetrators.
All right, here's what we're going
to
do.
We have to look at the cycle
of violence. Mr. Husseini, calm down.
Calm down.
What we're going to do is we're going to take out this Osama bin Laden. Now, whether we go in with air power or whether we go in with a Delta Force or whatever, he's a dead man walking. He's through. He should have been through long before this. He's been wanted for 8 years. Now they're going to go in and they're going to get him. If the Taliban government of Afghanistan does not cooperate, then we will damage that government with air power, probably. All right? We will blast them.
Who will you kill in the process?
Doesn't make any difference.
No, it does make a difference. I don't want more civilians dead. We've had civilians dead in New York, and now you're saying maybe it's okay to have civilians dead in Afghanistan.
Mistress, this is war.
Stop it. This is war. Exactly. And in war, you don't kill civilians. You don't kill women and children. Those are your words, Bill.
Oh, Lord, our Father, our young patriots, idols of our hearts. They go forth to battle. Be thou near them, with them, in spirit. We also go forth from the sweet peace of our beloved firesides to smite the foe. O Lord, our God, help us to tear their soldiers to bloody shreds with our shells. help us to cover their smiling fields with the pale forms of their patriot dead. Help us to drown the thunder of the guns with the shrieks of their wounded, writhing in pain. Help us to lay waste their humble homes with a hurricane of fire. Help us to wring the hearts of their unoffending widows with unavailing grief. Help us to turn them out roofless, with little children to wander unfriended the wastes of their desolated land in rags and hunger and thirst. Sports of the sun flames of summer and the icy winds of winter, broken in spirit, worn with travail, imploring thee for the refuge of the grave, and denied it. For our sakes, who adore thee, Lord, blast their hopes, blight their lives, protract their bitter pilgrimage, make heavy their steps, water their way with their tears, stain the white snow with the blood of their wounded feet. We ask it in the spirit of love, of him who is the source of love, and who is the ever faithful refuge and friend of all that are sore beset and seek his aid with humble and contrite hearts. Amen.
This is from Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War by Matthew Lazar. The chapter is God Bless Pacifica. It was September 10th, 2001. The next morning, WBAI's Robert Knight lay on his bed and stared at the ceiling of his apartment. Knight lived on the 32nd floor of a huge apartment complex in Lower Manhattan, right off the East River. From his spacious living room window, he could see the Bronx, Queens, and the United Nations building nearby. From his bedroom, he could survey the entire Manhattan skyscraper line from Battery Park to the Empire State Building. Far beyond, in fact, thanks to a small collection of telescopes. As Knight lay there, the radio chattered in the background. He was in a bad mood, having gotten little sleep that night. Knight rose, checked on the news on his computer, and tuned to the radio to WBAI, from which he had recently been fired by Utrice Lead. Listening to the station put him in a worse mood. Bleary-eyed, he went back to bed. Then he noticed the plane. Quote, "I could see the wings and all different parts of it," end quote, Knight recalled. "It flew at a disturbingly low altitude right over a densely populated area of Manhattan. You never see planes there," he later explained, "because the Federal Aviation Administration has rules that traffic has to fly over the Hudson River and sort of avoid the center of Manhattan." Still half asleep, Knight puzzled over what he had observed. "It's like when Niagara Falls freezes," he said. "You know that there's an anomaly." Then the radio announced that the World Trade Center had been hit. He rushed to the window, and there to his horror stood the Northern Tower in flames. Knight immediately turned on his satellite cable TV in his computer and grabbed a long telescope. He pointed it at the building. "You could see the black smoke coming out of the impact zone of the plane," Knight remembered. But having covered many fires as a reporter, this blaze struck him as different. "I could see it burning in places where it should not be burning. I could see it burning 10 and 15 stories above and below. Little pockets of flame." Suddenly, the second tower exploded. Knight jumped back and desperately scoured the radio dial for news. Two planes had hit the complex en route from Boston and headed to California, one commercial station reporter explained. "There must be some kind of navigational error that's drawing the planes to this place," the announcer speculated. Knight shuddered. No, he felt sure this was no error. "I knew that this was a maximal bomb. Two giant bullets filled with high-density kerosene jet fuel." The telephone rang. KPFA's Dennis Bernstein and Democracy Now! Wanted Knight to go live with a report, and so Knight narrated the September 11th attacks from the vantage point of his apartment. Armed with his telescopes, he described the collapse of the buildings, smoke cascading into the sky, thousands of New Yorkers fleeing Manhattan on foot via bridges, soot and debris floating up the East River, the FDR Drive cleared for ambulances. And to his dismay, the paucity of survivors as it became all too clear that most casualties caused by this terrorist act would be fatal. And that's a reading from Uneasy Listening, Pacifica Radio's Civil War, by Matthew Lazar.
We are broadcasting not far from the World Trade Center towers. Both have gone down in the last hours in a massive attack that seems to extend from New York to Washington, D.C., where all federal buildings have been evacuated. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. The latest news we have is that there have been widespread attacks that include at least three commercial jet crashes. We now believe perhaps four. Three commercial jet crashes into significant buildings. In the first attack, a plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan shortly before 9 o'clock, followed by another plane into the second tower about 20 minutes later. Both towers later collapsed. About an hour later, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, part of which later collapsed. American Airlines told CNN that it lost two planes in tragic accidents. Flight 11 from Boston with 81 passengers and 11 crew aboard, and Flight 77 from Washington Dulles Airport with 58 passengers and 6 crew aboard. Both planes were en route to Los Angeles. United Airlines Flight 93 airliner headed from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco crashed near Somerset, Pennsylvania. Police said initial reports indicated no survivors. It was not known if this was connected to the attacks. United also said it was deeply concerned about Flight 175 from Boston to Los Angeles. The Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, the Justice Department, the Capitol, the CIA, and all other government buildings in Washington have been evacuated. President Bush canceled an appearance in Florida to return to Washington, calling the crashes, quote, apparent terrorist attacks and, quote, a national tragedy. In the first ever national ground stop of aircraft, all flights nationwide have been stopped at their departure airports. All international flights were diverted to Canada. In New York, more than 10,000 rescue personnel have rushed to the scene. The entire downtown area of Manhattan, the mayor has recommended people evacuate, though we are in that area and certainly so are thousands of other people. Israel has evacuated all its missions around the world. In Chicago, the Sears Tower was evacuated. The United Nations in New York has been evacuated. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was evacuated. CDC was preparing bioterrorism teams in case they become necessary. The New York Port Authority says it has closed all bridges and tunnels into the city. Today is primary day in New York. These elections have been canceled. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we go first to Robert Knight, who is on the line with us. He is right by the United Nations. Robert, can you talk about what you saw this morning?
Yes, indeed. I am reporting from an elevated location on the East River within line of sight to the United Nations, as well as the World Trade Center and the Empire State Building. This morning at approximately 15 minutes before 9 o'clock, I was disturbed looking out of my window with the sound and the quick passage of what appeared to be a commercial plane. It was unusual because the general aviation rule in New York is that north and southbound traffic must travel over the Hudson River. This plane was too close to the center of Manhattan. As it traveled south, it caught my attention, and minutes later, a plane would indeed crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. I believe that is the plane that I saw. What is remarkable about what we now know to have been two crashes into the World Trade Center is the anomalous behavior in Manhattan now. The Empire State Building has been evacuated. The United Nations Secretariat and General Assembly buildings have been evacuated. As I look down at this very moment on the East River as the tide rises, there is an unusual pattern of fine-grained debris, which I believe has washed up from Lower Manhattan by this amount of time since the initial crashes. There have been closures of tunnels and bridges coming into New York, but as I look through the telescope, I can see torrents of pedestrian traffic moving eastbound across the 59th Street Bridge to move out of Manhattan. The bridge is closed to automobile traffic. Right now, as I look down on the FDR Highway, that is an expressway that runs on the east side of Manhattan, north and southbound, it has been closed to traffic for some hours, with the exception of police, fire, ambulance, and other emergency vehicles. It has been almost like a ghost highway, except for the ferrying and shuttling of ambulances with what few people they can bring back from what has to be a tremendously high toll of the explosions at the World Trade Center. As I look north at the United Nations at this very moment, it is being circled and ringed by a number of police boats, presumably under the assumption that the United Nations might well have also been a target. One other significant factor, Amy, I think that should be noted tactically or logistically. If indeed there is a central coordination of the crashing of these commercial airliners, I think it's significant that those that are missing are those that were outbound from the East Coast for destinations on the West Coast. That means that these planes would have had the maximum amount of jet fuel in them, and if that was a factor, it would have been a logical one, so that when, for instance, the second plane crashed into the Southern Tower, there was a tremendous fireball. So it remains to be investigated, although it seems plausible that choosing a long-distance flight would provide more fuel for more deadly explosive effects.
I wanted to bring Reem Katkhuda into this discussion. We're talking about two 110-story towers of the World Trade Center. 50,000 people work there. 150,000 people are there every day. The number of casualties at this point are untold, but they must be extremely high and devastating. Reem, what did you see and hear?
I was stuck on the roof with a clear view of both towers, and there were flames coming out of the towers, 20 feet high flames, and lots of smoke, mostly dark, and then the smoke started to get lighter, and then suddenly the second tower, the more south of this, kind of like exploded and then collapsed in itself with debris falling everywhere. It was definitely a full building collapsed from where we were looking at. That's how it looked, and it was crumbling. And the second tower was oscillating at that point, probably from the wind of the first one, and we could see it clearly. It was a very big angle, visible angle. It was swinging, and that's the tower with the antenna. I also saw the huge amount of smoke and steam floating and almost covering the downtown area. And here with us on the phone, I have Kasia, my neighbor, who actually saw the second tower collapse.
We kind of hoped that the second tower would not collapse because the fire was in the upper part of it. But it happened the same thing as with the first tower. It just suddenly collapsed straight down, and the only good thing was that it went straight down and not, you know, on the other buildings that are there. So we were all shocked.
People were crying on the roof. People were hugging each other. People were trembling head to toes. It was a horrifying sight, and even for me, who's seen a lot of buildings collapse in Lebanon by vacuum bombs and others, it was just horrific to see it. We looked around town, we looked at Midtown that was very visible from where we're at, and people were saying, like, will there be another thing? Will there be another thing? Slowly, the smoke that stood in place of the two towers moved a little bit lower within the lower area. And there were a lot of ambulances, a lot of fire trucks going. And when I went down to the street, I saw a lot of people who went to school to get their children. People talked about people burned head to toes. And the emergency rooms and the different hospitals need blood. That's what the word was on the streets. People were telling each other, have you given blood? Are you going to go give blood? Because people need blood in the hospitals.
Amy?
Robert Knight.
In reference to Mayor Giuliani, for our national audience, not everyone might recall that sometime after the ground level bombing of one of the World Trade Center buildings, that Mayor Giuliani subsequently established a so-called crisis and terrorism center, an emergency so-called bunker, which was oddly enough located on the 22nd floor of the World Trade Center. Of course, we now know that he was not in that center, fortunately, this morning, and was operating out of a firehouse in Greenwich Village. The mayor did indicate that he has been in touch with the governor, George Pataki, of New York State, and that National Guard has been alerted and is en route to help relieve and assist the some 10,000 or more emergency service personnel whose work will be endless over the coming days. So we expect the arrival of state level authorities to assist in the emergency search and rescue operations for the untold number of casualties that will have eventually been discovered.
Robert Knight reporting to us from the United Nations area. And just for people who are outside of New York to get a picture of the island, he is about halfway up on the east side. He is on the East River. The United Nations up around 44th Street and 1st Avenue, World Trade Center at the tip of Manhattan. We are in the middle, just above the tip of Manhattan, broadcasting from Chinatown from Engine Company 31, where Downtown Community Television and Manhattan Neighborhood Network have graciously given us their studios in this monumental tragedy that is taking place, unfolding as we speak. This is a national emergency for the first time ever. All flights have been canceled in the United States with the what appears to be attack on the World Trade Center towers. Both have collapsed. The images this morning, and we're going to bring Robert back up as he was watching, as well as Reem Khairhuda, the images on television of people hanging on to the World Trade Center towers, those top floors, jumping before those towers collapsed. But after the first plane went into one of the towers, it was about 8:45. Then 20 minutes later, the second, what appears to be attack on the towers, and then by 10:30, both towers had collapsed. Robert.
Yes, as I watch the ongoing activity on the eastern side of Manhattan, of course, the smoky tableau of the empty space in the horizon where the World Trade Towers used to be continues apace. There is debris that I believe came from that area, even now visible on the surface of the East River. What I've been monitoring traffic and emergency-wise has been a shutting down to transportation of this artery, as well as, of course, bridges and tunnels coming into New York City. There is pedestrian traffic walking across bridges, the Brooklyn Bridge, walking across the 59th Street Bridge. Many people on foot evacuating Manhattan at this point in time. I noticed that many city buses have been drafted into service and are, I don't know, carrying police or health workers or others downtown every now and then. There is a constant stream of ambulances coming into the Bellevue Medical Facility area. There are a number of hospitals in what could be called, at least in part, a medical district on the middle eastern side of the island of Manhattan. But one cannot help but think that this trickle of ambulance traffic is far too little to have adequately served the thousands of people who might have been at risk with the unprecedented level of destruction in the southern tip of Manhattan.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. We invite your leaks, suggestions, tips, and questions with emails to theshadow@wbai.org. Thanks for production to Thiago Brozo. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.